Welcome to episode 54 of Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson, Michael Lucas Smith, and David Bach. This week, we started off the podcast with an announcement of a job position shift by James Robertson and Arden Thomas. And after that, we discussed domain-specific languages and, of course, rambled on as we normally do. Hope you enjoy it. If you have feedback, please send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com or head on over to iTunes or Podcast Alley or visit the Facebook group Industry Misinterpretations.
To you about the things you've been putting me through now. I gotta talk to you, I gotta be explained to you. Hey,
yeah. Hey, alright, so Michael, you wanted to talk about
Did I?
Yeah, you said you wanted me to bring up the position change thing that we had talked about.
I think this is due disclosure that one of the people on our podcast is now a marketing person. You know, this is important for our listeners to understand that this show is not completely unbiased.
Oh, you mean the fact that I'm now a marketing puke? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm moving to product marketing management, which is probably more or less what I've been doing at Syncom anyway for the last 2-3 years anyhow.
Nothing, yeah.
Product manager will actually be Arden Thomas, although the two of us will be kind of sharing the two roles anyway. But yeah, formally speaking, Arden is going to become the product manager and I'm going to be product marketing manager. That'll be official as of October 1st.
So who is this Arden Thomas guy?
Well, Arden and I go back a long ways. It turns out the two of us went to the same high school. He was 1 year ahead of me. He actually had my dad as a math teacher. He knew my dad before he knew me, even though we went to high school together. He was one of the football players, and being that I was on track, we pretty much tried to stay away from the football team. But he joined Park Place, I think it was 2 years before I did. He joined Park Place in the early 90s. He was a sales engineer, and then I had joined Park Place a couple years later as a trainer consultant. And interestingly enough, around 1995, the two of us switched jobs then. And the reason we switched jobs was we both had the wild idea that we'd travel less.
How'd that work out for you?
It worked out okay for him because he was able to take the train into New York City to do the training. So his long-haul travel dropped. My travel changed. It didn't turn out. I probably traveled about the same amount, but I wasn't traveling 4 or 5 days a week away from home. So it worked out fairly okay for both of us. But it was kind of interesting that we're changing jobs now and we've done this same trick before.
So how does it affect your travel?
Not at all. I think we end up all the same places, mostly, other than the fact that he went to ESUG this year and I didn't because my daughter was starting high school that week.
So I do have to ask, what does a product marketing manager do that a product manager doesn't, and vice versa?
Well, marketing, they don't really do anything at all. They just make up bylines and logos and press releases.
Which is exactly why I asked the question.
You're making it sound like I don't do any work here, dude. Well, as it turns out, I do pretty much the same thing that I've been doing. Most of what I've been doing in terms of product promotion and product evangelism kind of fits more under product marketing than it does under product management anyway. The product manager is realistically supposed to be a little more tightly connected to what's going on with development. It's not that I haven't been, but I've been doing more than just the one role. So now that we've got Arden on board, or we've had him on board for quite a while now, but we decided that it made more sense to give him more of the product management task to get somebody actually more focused on that full time and let me keep doing what I like doing anyway.
Yeah, in fact, for many years you've been doing both roles.
Yeah.
Trying to do the marketing as well as the product itself, product management. So.
Right. So what that really means is that people like Michael are now Arden's problem.
Yeah.
Okay, well, very good. Congratulations, Arden. Congratulations, James.
Yes, congratulations. But what it means now is that this podcast has on it a marketing guy.
Oh, dear.
Well, product management is sometimes organized under marketing, so you could argue that it's been that way for a long time.
See, that's a very marketing sort of thing to say.
Well, actually, back 3-4 years ago, I used to report into the director of marketing here at Syncom. They changed that around a while back, but I have reported into marketing before.
Is this meant to make us feel better?
Just think of all that IQ drop you've enjoyed over the last couple of years. Uh-huh. And remember, you can always refer back to the old Dilbert cartoon of the picture of marketing with the 2-drink minimum.
Yep.
So do we actually have a topic for today? I think so.
Yeah, you had wanted to talk about domain-specific languages and some of the parsing technology in Syncom Smalltalk or in Smalltalk in general.
Let me back up a bit. When you're looking around at other environments in C-sharp and Java and things like that, the term domain-specific languages has become quite popular, quite common. And people will write their own little, effectively little scripting languages or other mini languages specific to their domain and use those for development. So I thought it would be useful to talk about those from a Smalltalk context. Interestingly, from the Smalltalk community, it hasn't been something that's been talked about as much. And I think the reason is that Smalltalk itself actually acts as a little domain-specific language itself.
There's an interesting sidelight to that, too. There is a domain-specific language, or DSL, toolset that's written in Syncom Smalltalk. Metacase Consulting puts out a tool. The name is escaping me right now, which is probably a bad thing, given that they're a customer.
Metacase Plus.
Yeah, there you go. So they put out a tool that lives in that domain, and it generates DSLs for specific product domains.
This is what you're going to have to figure out as a marketing guy. You've got to remember people's names and stuff.
I remember Steve Kelly's name, and I he's even using my blog server.
So, anyway, from a Smalltalk perspective, we don't use DSLs as much simply because the language being so minimal and expandable, you can say a lot within the language itself and don't need something domain-specific.
I guess it depends on the kind of domain that you're dealing with. I mean, if it's a business domain, then yes, Smalltalk works pretty well. If it's some sort of, engineering or disciplined domain, for example, I find it easier to write CSS than to write Smalltalk code that generates CSS.
Mm-hmm.
Because, it's a matching language and it's geared towards that. And same with XML. It's easier to write XML than to write Smalltalk code that creates XML. Or JavaScript. It's easier to write actual JavaScript than to write Smalltalk code that will generate JavaScript.
Well, that kind of falls into the right tool for the right job domain more than DSLs, I think. And also, as far as generating things like JavaScript, to some extent, Seaside does an awful lot of that for you already, doesn't it?
Well, it doesn't generate JavaScript, right? It just wraps it up into nice libraries.
Okay, but no, okay, I oversimplified, but it makes it more accessible to someone who doesn't necessarily know JavaScript.
Yeah, but I think these do count as DSLs. That's just a different kind of domain to the sorts of domains we usually talk about when we talk about DSLs. And the really weird thing is that when a lot of people talk about DSLs outside of, well, especially in the Java world, they're talking about some XML dialect.
Yeah, XML as a programming language.
There was a long chat about that on one of the podcasts. Actually, they haven't put out an episode recently, but the Stacktrace did a rather long two-parter on XML a while ago, and they were on opposite sides of that as to whether that was a good thing or a bad thing.
Okay, let's vote. Bad thing or good thing?
Bad thing.
Bad thing.
If your answer is an XML document for a DSL, you've already made a mistake.
Can't you just say bad thing?
I'm in marketing. I have to use more words.
That's what I was worried about.
So if you were to do domain-specific languages within Smalltalk, there are various options available. Have any of you used Parser Generator?
The compiler? Compiler?
It's a part of the Advanced Programmers Kit, what used to be called APOC.
I've used that on occasion, although I can't say that I've done anything real with it.
Yeah, I'd like that. I wish Smack were actually integrated like that. I really like the idea of taking a different programming language and writing it straight into the Smalltalk RB browser. But the RB browser isn't really built for that yet. And actually, neither is the compiler hierarchy. So That's actually something that we changed at Wizard, and I've been thinking maybe that stuff should appear in Visual Works at some point in the future. I mean, it's really kind of nice to represent other languages and other ideas as methods on a class.
Although that actually can be done in the system. I mean, if you look at DLLCC, for instance, as many problems as the parser has now, and it's actually being, I think it's being reworked using Smack, if I'm not mistaken, but as many problems as that parser has now, it's actually implemented using the parser compiler, and on the class side of the class in question, external interface, it just specifies what compiler to use to deal with the instance side methods.
Yeah, I know, but that means you can't mix things. So the C parser compiler stuff that's there is actually an extension of Smalltalk, not a whole new language. So if it was a whole new language, then you wouldn't be able to actually blend the two together in the same class. It would have to be one language or the other. That's why I like the advanced tools one is the rules, your grammar, are just methods.
Yes. And in fact, if the method name ends with an equal sign, then that means that the body is a special pattern language specific to the parser generator. And if your method name doesn't end with an equal sign, then it's regular Smalltalk. So you just distinguish based on the name of the method.
So we had a change to the compiler hierarchy at Wizard that basically just auto-detected what language you were working with. And there's incredibly rare situations where you actually had to tell it what language you were working with. So that meant you could just blend different languages together on the same class.
How did you auto-detect what language the method was written in?
I just try to compile it, and it falls back to the... So, yeah.
It fails to compile a Smalltalk. Let's try Java.
Exactly. I mean, a bit of code. I mean, you're talking about a small method or even a long method. They fail pretty quickly if they don't match the rules. So the thing that you have to deal with then is which language, if it didn't work in any of the compilers, which language was it probably? And then you can give them errors. So, I mean, that was a challenge, and we kind of ignored that problem.
Well, that sounds like the same kind of approach the browsers use to try to figure out what encoding a page is.
Yeah. Although they just go, if it all fails, just UTF-8, which is what we do, right?
Yeah. Similar to what the image reader does when it tries to read a file. It'll try reading it as a GIF file and then say, oh, this doesn't look like GIF. Let's abort that and try reading it as a BMP file.
Yeah, you only
and
have
eventually one of them works.
Yeah, I mean, usually the header has a magic identifier on it that tells you what you're after. But the other thing we did was, because it was being saved as a Smalltalk method with non-Smalltalk source, you could actually associate some sort of Smalltalk code with that source. So in the case of what we did with the JavaScript stuff, we made it so that the Smalltalk method was the code to actually send a command to the remote browser to execute that JavaScript on the browser. So your Smalltalk methods could literally call the JavaScript methods and it would do an RPC across the currently connected browser. So things like that. If you've got a CSS method, so a method source at CSS, the Smalltalk code for that could actually return the CSS as a string or maybe even parse it into a CSS object or something like that. And that's really cool. That means that you're programming in the native language that you want to use, but that you can call it and it behaves in some reasonable manner in Smalltalk code.
That's pretty cool.
Doesn't Smalltalk X do something like that where you can inline C right in Smalltalk methods?
Yeah, that's actually pretty different. Everything that compiles in Smalltalk X is actually compiled with the C compiler. So it's literally just dumping that C code straight into the thing that it's compiling.
Okay, I had no idea that's how that worked.
One thing that I did many years ago, I was very frustrated by VisualWorks scanning of date strings. So being able to enter a date as a string and have it convert into a date object. It was just very cumbersome to use. So I built a program using the advanced programming tools, the parser generator, and it could parse any string, well, any reasonable date formatted string, and give you back a date object. And it had special words in it, like tomorrow. I could type tomorrow in, and it would give me back tomorrow's date. Or I could type next Wednesday, and it would give me back the date for next Wednesday. It was pretty cool, and that was all done with the parser generator.
Although I'd actually rather get back a tomorrow object, because tomorrow is tomorrow, and I would actually like the date operations to continue to work the way they did today.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that in real life applications, you tend to say, well, this activity is going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah.
So if you put a tomorrow object in, it would never happen.
Yeah.
Well, the reason Michael thinks that is that he's used to being in the future.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, for Michael, how many summers in a row have you been?
This is my fifth.
Fifth summer, I think. Yeah, right. Okay.
just give him another 2 months, and he'll see what Ottawa can kick in at him.
Yeah. Right?
So anyways, that's a neat little application of the parser generator. I actually did work on a little mini DSL for an insurance company. And we used the parser generator, and then we took the results and actually compiled it down to our own little bytecodes and then interpreted the bytecodes.
You know what really fails us here? I mean, I think that's really cool, and I've done that sort of thing before. I think what really fails us in the Smalltalk environment right now is being able to debug this stuff. If you produce bytecodes that don't match the parse tree, or you produce a parse tree that doesn't match the source code, in other words, you're doing transformations at any level, then the debugger gets totally lost.
Well, actually, that's what I was going to ask you, Dave. Why did you produce your own bytecodes instead of just compiling into Smalltalk bytecodes?
The system that we were developing, they needed some sort of interpreted language that was separate from Smalltalk. They didn't want to give the users access to full Smalltalk.
I could use the sandbox stuff. It's in public store. Sandbox.
Well,
Smalltalk.
Yeah, but this might have been. This is probably going back a ways, isn't it, Dave?
1996.
Right.
Well, you could have made the sandbox back then.
But we started off with just an interpreter tree, which worked pretty well. But the problem with the interpreter was that it required a lot of fetching from the database to get the node objects back.
Mm-hmm.
So we just built a little mini interpreted language and
database.
Pardon me?
Did you say database?
Yeah, we stored the interpreter nodes in the database, which was inefficient.
I'm shaking my head right now. I'm speechless.
But
inefficient, that's one way to put it.
I'm trying to figure out who thought that was a good idea.
It actually worked pretty well for what they needed to do. They didn't need high performance out of this. They just wanted something that was a little bit customizable.
I mean, that would probably run slower than a Commodore 64.
Since then, VisualWorks changed the VisualWorks bytecodes several times over.
Mm-hmm.
We had the bytecodes in the database guy on for an interview once.
Oh, that was a different thing, though. They actually stored real, honest-to-goodness VisualWorks bytecodes in the database, and that caused problems. This one was our own bytecodes that we managed. So we just created our own little mini-interpreted stack language and interpreted that, which worked pretty well, surprisingly.
But you know that bytecode and parse tree, they hold the same information. If you represent the entire parse tree in bytecodes, it's a compressed version of the parse tree. So to have one or the other is actually the same thing.
Which is actually what we did. We started off with a parse tree and then later switched to bytecodes to make it more easier to pull out of the database.
Do you know what's kind of annoying is that in VisualWorks and most languages that go from parse tree to bytecodes is when they go to bytecodes is they lose information. And so especially in VisualWorks, we lose information. We unroll certain methods and inline other certain methods, inline ifs, etc. I think that was a mistake. I mean, if you're going to optimize if statements, etc., do it at the layer underneath the bytecodes when you go and JIT it. And that's just my take on it. I would rather not have lost that information. And that way you don't need a real parse tree representation. You can generate the parse tree as you step over the bytecodes, and it's all the same thing. Oh, well, can't have everything.
For novel domain-specific languages, one weird one that I did was for a virtual world, and I wanted to have a bartender that could serve drinks in this virtual world. So you could go to the bartender and say, order Michael a drink, or order Michael a beer. And the bartender says, yes, sir, right away. So anyway, I actually started off using the parser generator for that. It worked okay. I had a few problems. I ended up rewriting it and using a different technology, which worked a bit better. But
surely the most complicated DSL out there has to be, what's that text adventure game that everyone...
Oh, the Colossal Caves game, the adventure game.
No, not that one. I was thinking of the big one.
Zork.
Zork?
No.
Okay.
It's kind of NetHack.
Oh, NetHack. Okay.
NetHack is massive. Massively massive. Mm-hmm. And its DSL is built in such a way that any content added to the game gets integrated into the DSL. So it's a self-growing, evolving DSL.
Well, that's pretty scary.
Well, isn't that kind of what Second Life is supposed to be as well, that the content gets added to that system as well?
It's not really a DSL, though.
Well, no, I understand that, but isn't that kind of what that kind of world does? I mean, that's kind of what that genre is all about.
Mm. No. No, I mean, with NetHack, it's more that, you know, you add a module and it gets compiled in. You're thinking more like Moos and Mux and okay. Muds and those sorts of things where you're effectively in an object-oriented execution environment. Commands added to objects affect the room that you're in. And yeah, Second Life is definitely like that.
The nice thing about the parser generator and APOC, I keep calling it APOC, I'm sorry, and the advanced tools kit, is that it's nice and simple, but it's not terribly powerful from the point of view of compiler technology.
It's straight LR.
It's LL.
Oh, okay, even worse.
Yeah, it's an LL. So it's not even an LR parser. There's SMACC, SMACC, which is a parser generator built by the Refactoring folks, guys. The Refactoring browser guys, John and Don. And then there's also TGen, which is an older one, which is also a full LALR compiler generator.
Now, why did SMACC supplant TGen? I mean, TGen was out there for a while, and then SMACC came along. What was the defect in TGen that made them create SMACC?
I think TGen was just more complicated. And SMACC, they were looking at something to do to parse the Smalltalk code specifically and to do the refactorings with it.
They generated the Smalltalk parse tree with that's in the RB. So that's the RB parser and RB nodes, etc. And on top of that, they wrote all of the rewrite rule stuff as well. So they've done more with it, and I can only assume that creating the Smalltalk structure, classes, etc. from SMACC is significantly easier than in TGen.
Although the DSL that is the rewrite rules is not something that I would use the word simple in the same neighborhood as.
No. I'm not sure how else to do it.
Well, I don't know. I know I was at a tutorial that Neil Ross gave on it maybe 3-4 Smalltalk solutions ago. I took notes for, I think, going on 3-4 pages. I posted it on my blog. It was really hard to follow. And I don't mean that Neil made it hard to follow. It was just hard to follow.
I guess this is where the rewrite rules, which is what you're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah, I tried following that. I've come up with my own little patterns. I just say, quote, quote, at for everything. And that's a start cycle. It's back quote, at, variable name. That works.
I don't care what it is. Just get it.
That's the way a lot of us treat regular expressions. We're not sure what the hell it is, but we just type what we know works.
I'm going to have to do it for you. Just throw it at the keyboard. Regex comes out. Actually, Paul Perrin comes out.
Actually, that's pretty much how I was dealing with the Apache rewrite engine in the last couple of days as I was fixing up the blog server to move it from one machine to another. I kept throwing rewrite rules at it until it worked.
Yeah, Pete was real impressed with that.
Yeah, he was fairly nonplussed.
So,
it's Pete Hatch, BWA engineers who deals with a lot of our service and for some reason deals with James when he makes lots of rewrite rules.
I have a goal of getting a rewrite rule that works as opposed to one that might be good. Mm. As I've explained to him, I know just enough about rewrite rules in Apache to be dangerous.
So back to DSLs and parsers and compilers. It was brought up, I think, last week or the week before the Eclipse guy, that they're moving Eclipse towards an architecture where you supply the grammar, the lexer and the grammar, and a significant portion of the environment builds itself.
So is that on the agenda for Syncom Smalltalk?
Well, I mean, we wouldn't want it to build itself. I think this whole idea of templated code comes from languages that don't let you express what you want to do as well. And you're better off not generating code, but making classes that know how to run this stuff and are base classes that you could subclass and specialize, but work just fine on their own. I would like to see that in Syncom Smalltalk, but I don't think there's any real demand for it at this point.
It's one of those things that would be cool, but it'd be hard to justify.
Yeah, you don't get customers asking for that kind of functionality.
Well, to go back a number of years now, we had at one point at Park Place Digitalk, even, this goes back that far back, there was the effort called Frost, which you might remember.
Yes.
Which was to put Java VM implemented in Smalltalk. And we went a fair ways down that road and had Java implemented in Smalltalk, and the answer we kept getting back was more or less, that's really cool, but why do I want it?
Speaking of that project, one gotcha that gets me every time I go looking for something that can write out GIF files, if you go into the repository, you'll find a package called GIF Encoder. every time I go looking for a way to write GIF files, I inevitably run over the GIF encoder, which is for the Frost project. It's the general something or other format, which is a Java thing, not graphics format.
So is there a GIF encoder, an actual GIF writer?
Yeah, there's a couple. there was one hidden inside Visual Wave.
Yeah, Visual Wave had, actually there were legal issues surrounding that for a while. There was a GIF writer in that. Then there was that whole patent case that came up. And for a while they had the GUF encoder, which was the free version of that. And I think there were like two customers that actually cared enough to use it, and everybody else used the other one.
Yep. So I extracted that code out for the Seaside project because one technique that people use in Seaside is to generate some graphics, encode it as a GIF, and send it down dynamically, which is pretty cool. So that's extracted out of Visual Wave now, and that'll be in VisualWorks 7.6 or 7.51 or whatever it gets called. But there was another one that I think came from Epigent, but it didn't do transparency. What was it about that? There was some kick that, you know, Travis was trying to do something with GIFs and both libraries failed to do exactly what he wanted. But, oh, well, that's tough luck. You know, ironically, it's really hard to find things to write images out in VisualWorks. I mean, it's hard enough making them read images. We really should hook up to Graphics Magic or Image Magic or Devil or something like that. And all of those libraries have significantly large numbers of image reading formats and image writing formats. And then it's complete non-issue, but we haven't done that yet.
In fact, I know a couple of Smalltalk projects that do just that. They either reference Devil or I forget the other graphics libraries, but other graphics libraries that do image reading, image writing, and image processing.
I think the mother of all libraries there is the Image Magic / Graphics Magic. They're basically the same code base, except that the Graphics Magic guys promise to keep backward compatible APIs, not be assholes about it, which is not insulting anyone at Image Magic. This is, there's apparently this irreconcilable divide between the two projects, and that's it.
Well, this is one of the great divides in Smalltalk that goes back a ways, though, and this, we've talked about this before. This is that thing where there's an awful lot of people in Smalltalk who have kind of the, it's kind of a version of the of NIH. And it's not that they, it's not that people are afraid of stuff that wasn't invented in Smalltalk. It's almost that people want to have a version of it in Smalltalk, or it's somehow not pure.
Yeah, I've seen that before.
I'll tell you what's not pure: having a JPEG reader library written in Smalltalk code that can't read progressive or JPEG 2000 image format.
Oh no, no, I'm not justifying this theory. I am not justifying this theory. I'm just saying this is kind of what runs through the Smalltalk community. And it's hardly just CINCOM Smalltalk that it runs through, but it's something that's very common to Smalltalks is implement a version ourselves, because if it's in Smalltalk, it's easier. And, you know, for some things that may be true, but in general, if somebody else has written a whole bunch of a whole huge library that handles every image format known to man, it's easier just to deal with it.
I take it back. Pure is the right word. Pure as in, you know... Crap.
Oh, now you're going back to the 19th century England where we're talking about the pure finders. Yes, okay.
Yeah, isn't that what happened with the SSL code in Smalltalk, the CINCOM Smalltalk?
We now have both a version that we wrote ourselves, and we also integrate with the open, with, I think it's OpenSSH we integrate with.
You know, there's an interesting example of this going on in Squeak right now, and I'm not sure if it totally applies because... Anyway, I'll put it out there, and then if I get flamed, then so be it. Morphic 3. There's a UI framework in Squeak called Morphic, and some guy's making Morphic version 3. And his goals are very, you know, good. He's making it point-based instead of pixel-based, so the corners are point-based. And with multiple backends sort of thing, being able to do everything Morphic can do, which is rotate windows around and widgets around, make it all completely compatible and just all fits together nicely. However, to me, this sounds a lot like Aqua, WPF, Cairo, all of those ilk. I'm wondering, you know, is it really worth the effort of making it in Smalltalk when you could actually hook up to one of these other libraries? I don't know. I mean, at the same time, you look at Cairo, which is really a fantastic library, but it's progressing a bit slowly with respect to hooking up to fast backends and that sort of thing.
Well, what you just went through reminds me of two things that I saw both recently and a while ago. There was a project in Squeak that I have no idea what kind of progress it made to hook up to the WX Widgets cross-platform GUI library. And I saw this presented at Smalltalk Solutions in Orlando, and it looked like the guy doing it had made a fair bit of progress, and I've heard nothing about it ever since. I don't know if he's the only person working on it and the Squeak community just isn't interested, or if it's progressing nicely and I just don't know about it, but it's something that seems to have fallen off the radar. And then just this morning, I was looking at an email that came through from Anthony Blakey, and it turns out he's mentioned that he's working on an interface to XPT, which his goal is to actually embed the Gecko engine inside VisualWorks.
Yeah.
And if he was able to do that, now that would be pretty cool, because then you'd have most of the goals that you had originally with Style implemented across a wide range of platforms, because the Gecko engine runs on everything.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be nice.
Okay, very good. I think that pretty much wraps up the DSL topic.
Along with the required rambling that we always do.
As always. Last week we talked about widgetry, and we suggested that this might be a good possibility for an open source type collaboration. Since then, several people have come forward and they're interested in collaboratively working on the widgetry platform. So if anyone's interested in joining them, there's information on the VisualWorks NC mailing list, or you can contact us and we'll get you in touch with the people involved.
Yeah, if you Google VWNC mailing list, you'll turn that up, the mailing list in question, up pretty fast. I'll add the same caveat that I added into the mailing list, that CINCOM doesn't have any objection to people working on that, but people working on that should have no expectation that CINCOM will help with it either.
Or that it'll be open sourced.
Correct. Well, that would be part of helping. And I'm not trying to sound like a jerk, it's just that's the decision that was made for a couple of different reasons that I'm not really going to go into right now. Now, I should make an announcement. There are going to be a number of podcasts coming up over the next few weeks or months. I don't know what schedule I'm going to release these on. A bunch of us are going to be in Cincinnati next week for a meeting on Seaside. Michael is, of course, heading up that project, and we're going to have a meeting to get some cross-training and some cross-working going on. We're going to do a podcast with Michael and probably Alan about Seaside and Glorp. We're going to try to do one with Martin Kubetic and Tamara Kogan about some of the OpenTalk work. And on Thursday, we plan to do a podcast with some of the Gemstone folks.
Big Seaside week.
Right, and actually we'll probably be talking mostly about Seaside with the Gemstone folks, because I expect that'll be most of what they want to talk about.
Yeah, we've also got Michelle Benny will be there as well, so hopefully we'll be able to get him on the podcast.
I'm hoping that he'll join Alan and you on the podcast that we come in on.
Okay.
So I don't know what schedule I'll be releasing those on, but we have a lot of stuff coming up.
And we also have some interesting interviews coming up that haven't been officially arranged yet, so I don't want to give too much information about them. But okay.
Some things will be happening, but I can't tell you.
You think it's worth dropping a few names, James?
If you feel good enough about them happening, sure.
Well, we're going to try to get Dave Thomas, Smalltalk Dave, or who we know as Big Dave, onto our podcast in some upcoming weeks.
You know, it's only fair to try and get Pragmatic Dave on at some point as well.
That would be cool.
Yeah, I've met him. Maybe I'll try to drop him a line.
And Doran Sandhu, the author of Embrace Smalltalk, said he'd be able to do a podcast with us coming up sometime soon.
And, you know, along those lines, it'd be nice to try and get in touch with the F-Script guys as well. You know, Pragmatic Dave and F-Script guys, I'm just throwing that out there. We've got no plans there whatsoever.
Yeah, mind you, we haven't had any contact with either of them. So the ones Dave Buck mentioned, we actually have made something that resembles an effort.
I would really like to have a podcast with Dave Thomas, and Dave Buck on there. So we've got three Daves.
These are the Daves I know.
So does that mean I have to dig up the old soundbite the Mac used to have, where I can now have the Mac announce, "I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that"?
I once asked Big Dave if it was confusing having two Dave Thomases in the Agile world. And he says, yeah, sometimes it is, but fortunately we have the similar philosophies of software development, so I'm happy to sign his books.
All right, well, with that, I think we'll sign off.
Very good. Thanks. A good day, guys.
Bye. All right, bye.
Bye.
And now here's Dave Buck with this week's Cimbron Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbron Design Minute. Some people consider method comments to be a code smell. The argument goes something like this. If the method is complicated enough that it needs a comment to explain it, then it's too complicated. You should break down the method into smaller methods and simpler methods, and those simpler methods don't need comments because they're so obvious. I rather like this philosophy. If you can understand a method at a glance, there's certainly no need for a comment. And if you do have a comment, then it means that you can't understand the method at a glance and you should refactor it. So if you keep all your methods small and easier to understand, then your system becomes more maintainable, and ironically, the number of method comments seems to drop. This doesn't apply for class comments. I like having class comments to describe what the class does, and at higher levels, for instance at the package level, to describe what the package does. And most important, I like having an overall document that talks about the general structure of the system and how it all hangs together for people coming onto the project. This should be written after the project is stable, not before you start. This has been the Cimbron Design Minute. Cimbron offers training and consulting in object-oriented languages and the Smalltalk programming language. For more information, visit www.cimbron.com or email info@cimbron.com.
Stay tuned for James Savage with this week's Smalltalk Jobs Report.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Smalltalk Jobs Report. Richard Pearson, our Northeast Coast contributor, reports that in White House Station, New Jersey, Chubb Insurance is looking for a senior technical analyst who has excellent communication skills and experience with visual aids. Experience with Java and web development are considered pluses for this permanent position. Santa Clara, California, Real-Time Innovations is looking for a senior product marketing manager who has a wide range of knowledge, including Gemstone. San Jose, California, Orient Overseas Container Line, OOCL, is looking for a senior QA analyst with a wide range of knowledge, including Smalltalk. VisualWorks experience is considered a plus for this permanent position. Houston, Texas, Precision System Design is looking for a Smalltalk developer for a 3 to 6+ month contract. Contractors who work through Precision get 80% of the rate billed to the client. These are just a few examples of the Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. Good luck with your job hunting.
And that about wraps it up for this week. As always, send feedback to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com, head on over to the Industry Misinterpretations group on Facebook, visit us on iTunes and leave a review, or head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote. Until next week, have fun with Smalltalk.
Darling, I gotta talk to you about the things you've been putting me through now. I gotta talk to you, I gotta be explained to you.